Hear the words of the beloved apostle, St. John. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with you from God the Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, in truth and love. My name is James Dean Newcomb, and you are listening to the podcast that is overtly Orthodox. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Overtly Orthodox. My name is James Newcomb. I'm glad that you have pressed play on this episode, be it on YouTube or on your favorite podcast player. By the way, if you want to subscribe to the show, just go to overtlyorthodox.com and you'll find all of the buttons that you need. Wherever you want to listen to a podcast, it's most likely there. So overtlyorthodox.com. In this episode, I am really pleased to bring back to the program Frederica Matthews Green, who we can find at frederica.com. She's a Christian scholar, an Orthodox Christian scholar, a very sweet spirit, extremely generous with her time. And to give a bit of backstory behind this episode, when I first interviewed Frederica if you haven't watched it or listened to it, I will tell you that I was brand new to Orthodoxy. And I had just read her book, Two Views of the Cross. Last I checked, it was on Kindle Unlimited. So if you have a subscription to Kindle Unlimited, and I think it's there, and you can read it for no extra cost. Otherwise, it's a nominal cost. It's not exorbitant. So highly recommend Two Views of the Cross, her book. At this point, I had been attending Orthodox churches for quite a while. I'd been through the catechumen process, the series of classes. I believe I hadn't met with the priest to discuss my membership and baptism into the church, but it was close. It was close to that time. Maybe it had occurred, now that I think about it. At any rate, I was more or less betrothed to the Orthodox Church. So I was committed, and it was just a matter of time before we had the formal reception via the baptism. So my understanding had increased quite a bit. My familiarity with the Orthodox ways in the church had increased, along with my just being comfortable in my own skin as an Orthodox Christian. So that is a little bit of the background with me personally. At this point, I had started a show called Energeia, and that is the Greek word that is used in the New Testament. Paul used it a number of times to describe God's energy or divine energy that is working in us to do his will on this earth. And as I've said in other episodes of this show, I didn't have a concrete agenda as to what the purpose of the show was. I just wanted to have a show and let clarity come as time passes. That has manifested itself in this particular podcast, Overtly Orthodox. There's a number of reasons why this is the way to go, and I'll get into those perhaps in another episode. But suffice it to say that I wanted to talk to Frederica on the topic of energeia, and I emailed her and said, I've got this project and I'm looking to get, I just want to do this. Can you help out? And it turns out that she's written a great deal about energeia. She has a whole outline of listings of the use of the word and similar words throughout the Bible. And so that worked out quite well. If you go to the show notes for this episode, which is overtlyorthodox.com/Frederica2, overtlyorthodox.com/Frederica2, the number two, I will have that list of Greek words that are used in the New Testament to describe divine energy. So that is what we're about to hear. It was a lovely conversation, again, as can be expected, with Frederica. And we even brought my wife, Sana. She made a cameo appearance the last few minutes of the episode. We were talking about miracles that we have experienced in our lives. And so it was a great conversation. I am glad that you're here. And let's get to it. Here's my conversation with Frederica Matthews Green, recorded in January of 2024.
Frederica Matthews Green, author of Two Views of the Cross, you are now on the hot seat, and everything that you say from here on out can and will be used against you in the court of public opinion. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, James. And you? You're okay?
I'm excellent.
Yeah.
In fact, if I was any better, there would have to be two of me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
That's pretty good. The name of the podcast is Energia.live. And I interviewed you a while back, and I'm going to play that interview here on this podcast. So we have a bit of reference so we can get to know Frederica a little bit better as a person. And we had the conversation that we had was very free form, not really an agenda to it, but it turned out pretty well, all things considered. And then my son, who's 10 years old, gave me a book on podcasting. He said, Dad, you got to read this. It's called Podcasting 101. And the first thing that it said in this book was, have a topic to talk about.
Oh, okay.
And so I said, that's good advice. So why don't we just talk about the title of the show? It's Energeia. It's a Greek word. And I guess that it's not commonly used even by modern Greeks, but it's a very important word because Frederica is a very devoted Orthodox Christian, and the Orthodox refer to the Greek readings or the writings of the Bible, whereas most of us here in the West, at least, we rely on the translations into English from Latin. Frederica, why don't we begin with just a brief overview of, actually, I'd like to hear about this concept of translating from the Latin into English versus Greek into English. It seems that there's a bit of liability there in doing so.
I think there is. And I would want to plant this flag in the sand, make sure people recognize that the New Testament, at any rate, was written in Greek. It was written in a form of Greek called Koine, is how I learned to say it in seminary,
Koine.
But it's Kini now. And it means common. It's like koinonia. Yes. It's in common. And it was the language that was used in trade all over that part of the world.
Yes.
It was like English is today. It's like if you want to be doing business with anybody, you've got to speak this Koine Greek. It was not a particularly literary, gorgeous language, but it had a lot of words, so things could be defined pretty clearly. So that's the language that people were speaking to communicate. In fact, about 200 years before Christ, the Jewish scholars had translated the Old Testament from Hebrew into Koine Greek, because that was the language most people knew.
Okay.
So it's well established that way. And every language, as I say, comes with a map. It's like a map of reality. Mm. And the words define things, and they have certain flavors to them. It's a serious undertaking to translate the Bible into any other language, because it's really in the Greek it's best understood. Mm-hmm. Now, I know people are thinking, yeah, but it's Greek. It's too hard to learn Greek. But I had a Jewish man write me once, and he said, I hope this isn't a rude thing to ask, but you Christians keep having these arguments about Bible translations. Which translation is best? Why don't you teach your children to read the Greek? Because Jewish children learn Hebrew, and Muslim children learn Arabic. So it can be done. But we just don't, and then we're all grown up, and we're arguing about word choice in English.
And it's like a copy of a copy, isn't it, to translate from Latin into English? Mm-hmm. And Latin was translated from the original Greek, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. The St. Jerome made a translation of the whole Bible from Hebrew and Greek into Latin, and that was like in the early 400s when he did that.
And before we continue, there's a term, Septuagint. Is that the Greek version of the Old Testament?
Yes. Okay. Septuagint means 70. And the story was that there were 70 Jewish scholars who made this translation of the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek.
I just wanted to make sure that people listening know that term, because they may have heard it, but they don't really know what it means. But there it is.
There's so many terms of art, and it is important to stop and define. It does nobody any harm if you tell them something they already know, but you don't want to take off and have a basic misunderstanding.
Yes. Anyway, continue, please.
Yeah. I was going to say, St. Jerome there were sometimes problems with when there really wasn't a Latin equivalent. Mm-hmm. And one of these words, a very important one, is energeia, as you well know.
Yeah.
Energeia just means English. Energeia just means energy.
Right.
And English is such a magpie language that we just pick up words out of other languages and make them English words. So that's what happened with the term energy. But there was no equivalent in Latin. So St. Jerome, an earlier translation into Latin, had just transliterated energeia. And that way people could have started incorporating it and understanding what it meant. But Jerome chose the Latin words around terms like operatio, that to operate something, or an operation.
Okay.
And so it's a little bit different from energy, that if you say God is energizing in me versus God is operating me, it's more like a marionette if you're just being operated on. So I think that had very serious, even severe consequences for Western Christianity down the line. In Orthodoxy, we always translated the Bible, the worship, everything, into the local language. It was our tradition, translate into the vernacular so that people know what their faith is. But it was not that way with Latin. The Roman Catholic Church made the opposite decision, saying we can just freeze everything if we just keep it in Latin, keep it all in Latin. I think two things resulted from that. One is that, unfortunately, most people didn't speak Latin. And all those centuries, the European people, European peasants, people who are illiterate, they would be listening to the service in Latin, and they would probably pick up certain phrases, but they wouldn't really know what was going on. Right. So it led to a bifurcation between the ordinary people, who might be illiterate completely, and the scholars, who are mostly clergy and mostly in positions of authority, and they understand it's like their secret language. So it separated the ordinary people from the clergy, which was unfortunate.
Yes.
It also meant the sacrifice of these concepts like energy.
So you're not necessarily talking about the one specific word, energeia, being lost in translation. You're talking about there is this, like you go into court and the judges and the lawyers, they're their own little clique. And then there's everybody else. And that's why they keep saying, you have to have a lawyer. You have to have a lawyer because they're the ones that know the law. And they know this. They know the procedures. And if you get right down to it, it's really not that difficult. You do a little homework. But they like to think that they have this little advantage over the common people, for lack of a better term. And it sounds like this is what you're saying, only this is more, this is legitimate.
I would want to be generous and say that wasn't the plan. But it may have become very useful once it was happening. And so there was a tendency to have magical thinking about the Eucharist and things like that without any real depth of understanding. Okay. And on the other side, it was a tendency to over-intellectualize things. When you have a very intellectual faith, like the high Catholic rationalism, one thing that inevitably does is it makes people compete with each other. So you have scholars trying out to come up with something new so you stand out from the crowd and say how somebody else is wrong, prove how stupid he is, and then he's going to get even with you. And it's like the playground in eighth grade. It's human beings are susceptible to competition. And that, I think, was another misfortune, that an extremely intellectualized faith, it can become just a word game. And it can have unworthy motives, like getting ahead and becoming famous and defeating and getting even with somebody else. It looks to me like having it, having everything in Greek and then translating into the local language as they went, that worked out better for Orthodoxy. The reason it was translated into Latin was so people in Rome could understand it. That was the vernacular. But it didn't last that long. They were ceasing to use Latin, even in the early 400s. I'm afraid I'm just wandering. Do you want to try to pull me back down to any particular point you want to talk about?
It's fine. You talk about the Roman Catholic, and there, and I don't know, I'm not an authority on this, but I know that there were severe abuses of power with the Roman Catholic Church that led to Martin Luther posting his theses on the church door in Wittenberg. And I don't know that much about it. I just know that things happened that should not have happened. And it sounds to me like maybe this lack of understanding or lack of commonly available knowledge that could have been available had the Greek been translated into the common language, that could have been perhaps avoided if people actually understood what they were going to church. They would go to church, but they don't know what's going on. So it makes it easy for the clergy to manipulate things in their faith.
Yes, I think so. And there's always a temptation to power. Power corrupts.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolute
and no,
power.
And no one is immune.
No. Very tasty. If you have a little power, you just want more.
And I would gather, and I would go even so far as to say that even if you're in a position of power, it's more tempting, and it's more, you're going to be attacked more with that temptation.
Yes, yes.
That lust to dominate others.
It's like the as you taste a little of it and you get hooked, and then you want more and more. So we're blessed to be people who don't participate in that and don't particularly crave power, but we can just love the Lord and try to get closer to Him. That's the whole purpose of the Bible. That's the whole purpose of Christian faith, is for us to know Jesus Christ as Lord and to follow Him.
And you even mentioned this in your book. So it's not like we had just have to give this gratuitous, shameless plug for your book, because your book is completely relevant to this. Talk about the Latin didn't have an equivalent for energeia, sancti law.
Yes.
Use the Latin operatio.
Yeah. I'm going to look over here to the side where I've got, I have a whole document where I typed out every use of energeia in the New Testament. There are about 30 of them, and the majority are by, virtually all, are from St. Paul.
Right.
And as I looked at different Greek dictionaries, what I saw over and over is that it's not just any kind of energy. It means supernatural energy. Usually when St. Paul uses it, he's talking about God energizing within us. But there are a couple of places where he's talking about the evil one who is energizing in people to lead them astray.
Yeah.
So it's not the electric company. It is a supernatural kind of energy. And it's something that is within us and can get into us and get into our minds and be used through us to accomplish miracles. Let me, here's just a few of them. 1 Corinthians 12:11, one and the same Spirit energizes all these things, who apportions to each one individually as He wills. Ephesians 1:19, and what is the immeasurable greatness of His power in us who believe, according to the energizing of the dominion of His might, from whom the whole body joined and knit together by every joint with which it is supplied, according to the energizing in every single part, makes bodily growth and upholds itself, upbuilds itself in love. It's a word that St. Paul used a lot. And when I realized that, I thought how deprived I was to go through seminary and not ever know this, not know this is a prime concept for St. Paul. It was just papered over about, 1,600 years of reading the Bible in Latin in Europe and then reading English translations that are so influenced by the Latin that even if they did go back to the Greek, they're reading everything through the Latin worldview, which is, it sounds simplistic, but it is simply true that the Roman Empire was very legalistic. They had a lot of rules. It was very tough. There was a lot of fierce control and desire for discipline and all of that. So looking at what does the cross do? How does the cross save us? It would be so natural to immediately think we have this big debt, and then because Jesus suffers, it pays the debt. But in the Christian East and in the Greek New Testament, you see all this energizing going on. So it's about not payment, it's about Jesus dwelling within us and lending us his energy and working through us and working miracles. So instead of the legalism of Rome, we have in the Christian East a vivid sense of Jesus really being with us. There's a great emphasis on miracles. We Orthodox are trading around miracle stories all the time. It's childlike in some ways. And it just makes so much of a difference to believe that God is actually within you. It's the term that people like to use, re-enchantment, that we lived in a disenchanted world where everything is just matter, and that God is on some separate level or plane from where we are and operating like the marionettes. He's operating us, but he's not what the angels sing. Heaven and earth are full of his glory. His glory charges the entire universe. It is within every molecule. This is where God lives, infinitely beyond this, but also within it. There's no way to keep him out. It's his universe. He can be wherever he wants to be. That accounts, I think, for the very different feeling you get between European Christianity and Eastern Christianity. Instead of the assurance that the debt has been paid and everything is fair and square, instead of that, we get a childlike thing where life and power and strength and supernatural power are coming into us and filling us and all of those that we care about and everybody that we're hoping to bring to Christ and every vicious ruler in another part of the world. It's all God's matter. He owns this matter. And what we're trying to do is to yield ourselves to it more and more, to be able to bear that light and that power and to work the works of him who sent me, as Jesus said.
When St. Paul is using this word energeia, is it a matter of context by which we have the understanding that we have in the scriptures? Where I'm coming from is, if I am at the end of the day and I'm tired and I'm hungry, I'll say, I have no energy. So is that Paul using that word only in a supernatural sense, or is that literally what the word means, is divine energy?
Of course, a word's meaning shifts as time goes by. Mm-hmm. And at the time that St. Paul is writing, it's not that kind of energy. Okay. It is exclusively divine energy or demonic energy. And in many places, I think a half dozen or so, St. Paul even talks of God synergizing in us. I thought, synergize, that just sounds almost New Agey, but it's a legitimate word, that God is working within us and working with us to accomplish his will in the world. So at this time, and what we should understand as we're reading it, is that it's meant to be a supernatural. I hate to say supernatural, because it just reinforces the super. There's an upstairs and a downstairs. We live downstairs. God keeps himself upstairs. Really, it's fully natural, pervadingly natural.
But what I meant was, when I'm physically exhausted, I'll say I am out of energy. That's in a very natural sense. I'm not saying like the Holy Spirit has left me. It's just that I haven't eaten since 5 o'clock in the morning, so I need to eat.
Yes. So
I need to refill my energy source in the natural realm. But it sounds to me like the actual definition of energeia, it wasn't just a context thing. It was, that was the actual meaning of the word.
Yes. I don't know if you went back before the New Testament, maybe it would have included the sense of natural human energy that gets used up at some point. But at this time in 60 AD, when St. Paul is writing, I don't know enough about extra biblical literature to be able to say how it was being used there. But St. Paul definitely uses it to mean miraculous or demonic energy. It's never just ordinary human energy.
And it's not just good energy. It's also, it means it could be energy from above or below.
Yeah. Here's 2 Thessalonians 2:9. And he's talking about the lawless one, the evil, the antichrist who's coming. The coming of the lawless one, according to the energeia, the energies of Satan, will be with all power, dunamis, like dynamite. Dunamis is power, and with signs and false wonders. So there's an example right there of him saying the evil one is going to come with miraculous powers. But it's not God's powers. It's his own demonic powers that we will see. So you got to learn discernment and not just get bowled over by something that looks flashy or impressive.
This is good stuff. And we were talking a little bit before we hit record. And since this is you'd call it a rebranded podcast, because I'm repurposing some of the episodes that I did on a show called This Is What We Crave. And CRAVE is a very important acronym. And it's something that I created. And I say this in all humility, but I created it over the course of almost, I would say, years. It was an undertaking, years in the making. And the CRAVE acronym means community, respect, adventure, Wostan, and energy. And I wanted to part, because this is what we crave as human beings. We all crave community, people being like mine. We want respect from others. We crave adventure. We crave, Wostan is a Persian word that my wife, who's Persian, introduced me to. And I think loosely translated into English means righteousness, integrity, just doing things the right way. That's Wostan. And then energy. I wanted to have the word worship in there, but you don't crave anything. So I just like, how am I going to make this acronym work? I want to have the word worship in there, but I just couldn't find it. So I thought I was compromising to use the word energy to say that we all crave a relationship with a higher power. Mm-hmm. And Frederica and myself, we're both Christians. So we say that God and Jesus is that higher power. And so I thought it was a compromise to just use the word energy, but it turns out that I was spot on. And just wanting to do more with podcasts in the spirit of pick a topic, any topic, stick with it. I thought I have to stick with one thing. And what thing is more important than energy? Just like that, the greatest commandment that Jesus said, all of the law can be boiled down to love your neighbor as yourself. And I realized if we focus on that energeia, that divine power, then everything else will fall in place. We will be welcoming to everyone as much as possible. We'll be respectful. We'll have adventure. And we'll be compelled to do things with righteousness if we focus on energeia. And just, I was on my way to the Greek Orthodox Church one time, and there it was in my head. And I just typed it into GoDaddy.com. And that's where I buy all my domains. And it was the first thing. It wasn't even energeia.com. The first thing that I saw was energeia.lib. And I realized that's the name of the show, in energeia. So that, and for me, that is, I couldn't think of that on my own volition. I'm not that smart, but relying on that higher power, things just fall into place.
Yes. Yeah, they do. And miraculous encounters start happening. And you start seeing mysterious coincidences, like you think, God, you're behind this, aren't you? You made that happen. And all those things where a friend comes to mind and you pray for them, and then you find out it's a wonderful network that God has arranged in his world. And to begin to enter into that consciously and begin to see the results of it, it's sometimes scary because it's so much bigger than we are. There's so much power there. And that is what God wants us to do, is to participate in it to the extent that our feeble bodies can bear to participate in it.
You mentioned miracles earlier in our discussion, and I'd like to see if you could share anything about that, both as to how they operate in today's world, because I came from Presbyterian land, and they are pretty convinced that miracles don't happen. The Westminster Confession of Faith says so that we know that it's the truth. But yeah. tell us a little bit about miracles in the modern age, and if you have any examples that you'd like to share, I think it'd be great to hear.
Yeah. I don't know why the Reformation or parts of it set out to outlaw miracles, but I think maybe it had to do with believing that there weren't miracles, or that miracles were all demonic manifestations. Mm-hmm. And that the Catholic clergy were using them to control people. Mm-hmm. And so they had to scoff at it and put it down. What I always wonder is, for people in that confession, if somebody you love is sick, what do you pray for? Do you just not pray for healing, just in case, because it would be miraculous if it happened? Mm-hmm. I've always wondered about that. Often, if you anticipate and you expect that God is involved, so often things just happen that blow your mind. And I don't know if this is the most elegant I've ever experienced, but it was coming to mind in the last yesterday and today. So maybe it was in order for me to tell it here. Sure. It's a little bit weird.
Please.
I was going to a grocery store in the town where I lived, in Linthicum, Maryland, before we retired and moved here to Appalachia. And as I was walking through the parking lot, I noticed something on the ground that was crumpled up. It looked like a crumpled up leaf, except it was a slightly different color. It was a shade of green that didn't look right. So I picked it up and I unfolded it, and it was a $50 bill. And so I was like, I'm like looking around to see, is anybody looking on the ground? And then I went and I just stood in the little lobby and just waited to see if somebody came back looking around. Nobody ever did. So I kept it. So we're going to fast forward now about 5 years. The grocery store is no longer there. Now it's a Best Buy. But it's the same place, just the store chain has changed. I parked in the parking lot. I'm walking toward the store and I see something crumpled up on the ground, exactly the same. And I picked it up and unfolded it, and it was a $100 bill. And same thing, I kept looking around. Nobody was looking for money on the ground. When I thought about that, it actually gave me the chills, because it was just so deliberate. It was so playful in a way. I thought, maybe nobody dropped this $50 and this $100 bill. Maybe God just made it be there to make a point to me. And even though the store had changed, it was the same parking lot. It was right there as I'm getting closer to the store. That, boy, God does things for us that are so loving like that. And even playful sometimes, I think, because he wants us to enjoy his world. And he wants to delight us just as we want to delight our children. It's one of the best things about being a parent is seeing you're giving your child something that just brings on all the smiles. But I've had a million of those things. I like to say something about that, though.
Of course.
I was saying, I've experienced so many miracles. And the one that I've told a lot, but just to say it very briefly, was that when I was in college, I'd lost my faith. And then I became a lot of New Age stuff. And then I was a Hindu, not really a Hindu, but like a pretend Hindu. When I graduated from college, at our wedding, our hippy dippy wedding, I read a Hindu prayer And about almost exactly a month later, we were hitchhiking around the British Isles, and we were in Dublin, and we went in the church to look around, and I was looking at a statue of Jesus. And while I was looking at it, I heard a voice inside say, "I am your life. I am your life." It said more than that. I'm not going to go into the whole thing. But that was a shocking experience for me because I didn't even believe Jesus had ever existed. I thought he was just one of those characters that people make up because they need a rescuer or something like that. His presence was so overwhelming and undeniable that it has stayed with me 50 years now, 50 years later. It instantly made me fall in love with Jesus and crave to be near him every minute. So that was my whole life in Christ began with a miracle like that. And the point that I want to make regarding that is, as we all know, it's been a very rationalistic, intellectual couple of hundred years since the Enlightenment. And certainly what I grew up with as a young Christian till today is you have to have good answers for questions. You need to be able to respond when somebody challenges you. Judge McDowell has had a very well-known ministry of giving evidence that demands a verdict. It's all very much about, and brilliantly he does this, answering the challenges of atheists and others. But I read some years ago that he said it doesn't work like that anymore. Instead of people saying, "You have to defend that. I don't believe you. What are your grounds for believing that?" Instead, now they say, "That is so rude. How could you say something to say that Christian faith is better than any other faith? You might hurt somebody's feelings if they don't agree with that." So he recognizes there's a real ground shift, and the need to be able to spell it all out in logical form. We need something different today because there's not a hunger for that.
I wonder if that tact ever really was effective.
Well, yeah, because a defeated enemy is not a convert. He's just right. An angrier enemy. So it doesn't really, you can't convince somebody logically because it triggers all that competition stuff.
His stuff is good for preaching to the choir. If you believe a certain way and you want some validation for it, then I think it's great.
That works.
But to try to so-called win spiritual debate intellectually, it's just not going to work.
No, it really isn't. And we Christians have not known how to do something else because we were being challenged on the logic of it so ferociously. Right. And so we felt you got to give a good defense of the faith that is in you, as St. Peter says. And we certainly did do that. But as you say, it doesn't really result in converts. Being intellectually convinced worked for C.S. Lewis, right? Occasionally, there is somebody for which the intellectual argument flips them over. But for most people, it's totally different. It's the presence of Jesus Christ that wins them over. So I was reading lately somebody saying that among young people, the new atheism is gone. All those years we were trying to refute the atheists, you don't have to do that anymore. That's totally not what is preoccupying people. Instead, they're into paganism and in some cases, Satanism. They just don't know who Satan is. They're playing with fire. They're looking for experiences that are contrary to ordinary human life. They're looking for evidence that God fills this world. But they want to be able to do it on their own terms. And they're convinced that Christianity does not have this. Because maybe all they see Christians doing is answering logical arguments. So they don't believe that we have this aspect to our life in Christ. I think it's going to become more and more necessary in coming years for us to be able to tell our miracle stories, even if they're very small, even if it's just, I was going through a hard time and then I felt like God was near me. stories like that are actually easier to believe than mine. So I think we've got to get good at telling our stories. That's going to be our next task in terms of winning converts. And it's something that it's not like you win. It's not like you're trying to win that argument. You just say, I want to tell you a story. Can I tell you a story about something that happened to me? When I talk about this at a retreat, I always say, now I'm giving you a direction that you have to tell your story to somebody who is not a Christian. And you can go up to that person and say, I went to a retreat and the lady said, I have to tell somebody a story about one time God was close to me. Would it be okay if I tell the story to you? And of course, they're going to be full of curiosity. Of course, they're going to say yes. I think those stories are more persuasive. Those stories are something people crave. They're really looking for that. And they think Christianity doesn't have it. So it's wonderful when we're able to be able to supply that to them.
But that was Jesus's most persuasive ways, was telling those stories, illustrating deep truths with just telling about a simple farmer who's sowing seeds.
Yes.
And that's how he got the job done. But we think that we have to go, and that's so American to think we have to win everything. That's our culture, isn't it? The NFL, if you don't win the Super Bowl, you lost.
Yeah.
You didn't win the World Series, you lost.
You're lost.
If you don't come in first place, you're the first loser. And that's, it's just so American. But you go up into Asia, where I spent some time. My wife Sana is from Iran and spent most of her adulthood in Asia. Completely different. You celebrate someone who won, but the winners, they don't gloat. They're supportive of people being what people who they be.
It's more human, isn't it?
It is more human. It is more human. Yeah. And that is, what's another thing that people crave is just that respect, I think.
Yes.
Specific to the American culture, it's lost that with this lust for glory, having to win everything.
Yeah.
You have to win a debate rather than just say what you believe is true. And if people want to side with you, great. If they don't, then no one's the wiser.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That craving to win, that's a temptation, isn't it?
It is.
That desire to lord it over someone else. And Jesus said, among the Greeks, among the pagans, people in authority lord it over those who are beneath their control. And it will not be that way with you. Let the first be last. So,
we're sharing miracle stories.
You got one?
Yeah, Patty the Miracles. Okay, she has to put a shirt on.
Oh,
well, I'm gonna share. Well, she's dressed, but she's gonna put a shirt to be on the podcast on YouTube. Oh, I gotta watch myself. I'm gonna share a couple of stories of mine, and while Sana is getting dressed, she's gonna join us. I was on the way from Missouri to Georgia because I was stationed in Georgia, and I was in a church group. We had a conference in Missouri, and I had to be back in Georgia on Friday because I was in the band for the Army. So I had to be back Friday night, which meant that I had to leave Missouri Thursday night. And this was after a meeting in the morning and then an evening meeting, and it was very vibrant, very energetic, a lot of energia at the meeting. And so I leave probably 9 o'clock PM, maybe 10 o'clock PM. And of course, I'm 20 years old. I'm Superman. I'm invincible in my mind. I fall asleep behind the wheel. I'm in St. Louis. I fall asleep. And the next thing I know is I wake up and my foot is on the brake and I am veering into the exit lane.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
my foot is on the brake and I'm veering into the exit lane. probably 1996, 97.
So. Isn't that something? Yeah.
Yeah. And I had people in the car with me. That could have ended very differently.
Gosh, that's wonderful. That's not only miraculous, but it's a testimony of how much God loves you.
Yes.
It's a bouquet. It's a reminder of his love for you and his intention that there are things he wants you to do with your life. And he didn't create you for destruction. He created you for good works that are prepared for us beforehand.
All right. I have another story. Mm-hmm. This has to do with driving, although this time I'm going from Washington State to Minnesota. I grew up in Minnesota. That's where my family is. Now I'm at the Bible college associated with this church that I was part of in Georgia. It's in Washington. And the weather was calling for storms all the way from Washington to Minnesota. My grandma calls me on the phone a couple of days before I leave, and she says, James, we've been looking at the weather, and I know you're planning on driving here, but we're a little concerned about this. Do you think you might want to take a Greyhound bus to Minnesota rather than drive? And I said, ah, come on, Grandma, I'm fine. I'm good. So I get on the road, and I get into Montana. My car is awful weather, terrible weather, and my car skids off the freeway. Not off the freeway, but it hits one of those side things,
the barrier.
It damages my wheel, destroys the tire, but I'm able to hobble to the next exit where there's a hotel. I spend the night in the hotel. It costs me a couple hundred bucks to fix the wheel. Thank God everything wasn't worse than it was. And I get home, and this time it's driving 20 miles an hour. Because the weather is so bad. The thermostat in my car was damaged, so there's no heat in my car. It's 20 degrees outside. It's rain and sleet. And about 2 hours away from my home, a Greyhound bus flies right by me, splashes all sorts of mud and muck all over my car. I thought I should have listened to Grandma.
Well, that's one of those God has a sense of humor moments.
Yes, and I'm thankful I'm able to invite about it now. Sana, you are on the hot seat. Share your
come on over. Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
This is Frederica Matthews Green. Frederica, this is my wife, Sana.
Nice to meet you, Frederica.
Yes.
And James likes to do this. Yeah. All right. So what we're sharing, miracles.
Miracle stories.
Yes.
I had a lot of miracles in my life, and I don't remember all of them, but I like to share one story that just came to my mind when you said it. I was a student in Bangkok, Thailand, and I had a day off, and I just wanted to take a bus and just explore. They told me, if you take a bus, you can, if just one drive, and it just take you to a lot of locations that are touristic and a lot of people want to see. So that bus rarely comes to that bus station. And I was running, and I saw it coming from far. And I was like, will I make it to the bus station? Because the bus will only stop at the bus station. And I saw it's going really fast. Well, far it was passing through different cars, and there was not my bus lane, and I ran, and we both actually collided, like the bus stopped. I came to the bus stop, and the bus came there, and for some reason, it didn't stop. I don't know, because I was foreigner, and the driver wanted to make fun of me or make me run more, and I was like, bro, what? We just put on like accelerator, and I run, and he stops, and then I want to grab the thing to climb up. Another two meters. So it happened 3-4 times. We went off the bus stop. It was really strange. And then I gave up. I said, you know what? You can go. With my hand, I just show him, you can go. I can wait for another one. And I'm turning back, walking back to the bus stop to sit down. I hear this boom. the bus had gone into, I don't know how to explain, there was a highway and gone into the highway ramp and then hit another car. It was awful. I just don't want to say because I don't know what I have to say. The other passenger cars, it was, everything was smashed. Like, people didn't survive. And I was just speechless. I was looking and I'm like, it was not me. It was something else was pushing the bus, was telling me, don't get on this bus. I always remember. And prior to this incident, I had a dream that a bus going to have an accident and it's going to be really bloody. You might be seeing brain smash and stuff like that. And that comes to my mind. And I just lost my energy and I just slept on the floor around. Everybody is like, are you okay? Like, well, imagine how much, whatever power of, I don't know, my angel or whatever that was around. Power called, try to warn me for this day from 2 weeks ago. And I actually see what I saw in my dream. Wow. The same color of bus. I can remember the faces. So it was really planned for me to see what from the miracle is that I'm still here. If I was on that bus, I was part of that 20 people in the house. Maybe probably, I don't know how it would have been.
Wow. That's amazing. God was sure protecting you.
Still in my life that I cannot call it any other vocabulary dictionary. I will follow the rest of the sheep as miracle. it's absurd. I cannot define how I was informed or I hardly dream at night. Recently a lot because I'm thinking a lot, but my love, I hardly used to dream. A lot of people believe that you dream, but when you wake up, you forget. But I don't believe in that. I think if the human mind can sleep and reach to a level of conscious, that can dream, or there are some dreams that we find yourself here in it. They're different level of dreams. So yeah, I live in that dream, but once in a while, every time I dream, it was always a big question for myself. What did God want to talk to me? Why did I see that? And a lot of times, specifically when I was in age between 18 to 24, I was in another world of myself. I was very much involved with ministries and met thousands of people in my life during that period who were not professionally or, let's say, through jobs or anything related to me, and just through the ministry, I would go and see them. And I felt like God, I would pray a lot, and I felt like God really wanted to use me as a vessel to communicate with those people. I can honestly say I was not very specifically intelligent or genius, but I would do and say things that I would be like, stopping, wow.
Yeah.
And I said, let's not talk about this. Let's just let him do the work.
Yes.
But we have to just wait for our limited ability of a human, the ability that God gave us to explain or not fathom the magnitude of the things that happen around us. You just see it and pass it and let it be.
That is
those period, really, things happen. And I used to travel to borders of Vietnam and Myanmar where they keep some sort of a hut they created for Rohingyas. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this group of people. They are basic Myanmar, from Myanmar.
Yeah.
Well, they don't have any identity. None of the countries want to accept them. Even as a refugee, they have problems. So they are a group of people actually living on this earth that have zero identity, no passport, no registration, nothing. They're human like us. Very smart and intelligent people. So Thai government gave them a location on top of a mountain, which is not moving idol, but it's a place. So they have bamboo and banana leaves and bamboo trees. And there is a community pool, which was full of warm or whatever. They bath, they drink water, they cook, wash everything in that one bathroom, the whole community around.
Oh my goodness.
It took me a while to be strong to stay there for a few days. It started from an hour to just come back, go to church, my head down. There was a staircase to our sanctuary. I used to stay there at around 10, 11, sit down on the floor, put my head on the staircase and just cry. And I was like, what is that?
Yeah.
Here's something from you, but on the other hand, I see different thing in the world. So what are you doing?
Yes.
Well, yeah. I have no power.
If he's all for your feet.
I could teach English to the kids. I used to bring youth group with my new pastor up there. I was in charge of the girls. Teach them music and all those camps that we basically arrange for kids of all ages. I don't want to say I'm great. I had a lot of DVD and CDs of my work. People used to video me a lot, but I'm the kind of person, I don't like to keep pictures and video. Even good memories sometimes become sad for me. I don't know why. I think that was another miracle, because going up there, a lot of us got really sick and mentally didn't recover.
Oh, really?
And physically also, because of viruses and bacteria that was in the lung. It was not the most place to be, but I survived. I stayed there in the rain. We slept all night in the rain. Didn't sleep. Yeah, some protection was around me.
Yes.
Something was protecting me.
If you start adding those up, you think of more and more. Yeah, so that's what I hope, I pray will happen for you, is that you'll start remembering all these miracles and you'll have a whole basket full of them. Always have a story to pull out at the right time.
One more miracle that I want to share is the little girl. I used to be a student, and there was a time I told my parents, even though they were already well settled, well, my parents all their life were from me and my sister. I just wanted to become independent, and I was like, I don't need a dime from you. I can handle myself. I was very brilliant. And I found a place to live. It was over a slum area, a river in Bangkok, over the slum area. And I used to work really hard. I used to train the Japanese GMs or managers for Toyota, Unijang, Mitsubishi, because they have factories in Bangkok, how to present their cases in English, because, you know, Japanese, they're hard to get, they're smart, but language-wise, they only know Japanese, basically. So I used to work from 12 midnight till morning, because in the morning they would go to work, and Japanese are known for their hard work. They won't sleep. They go on and on. I remember I came back and I heard somebody's crying. It was pouring down, raining season. It was a little girl, maybe 16, 17 years old, and was holding something this size, maybe. So she was holding a baby, was born in her hand. And I'm like, God, what do you want me to do? I was all soaked. I don't know if you know how the rainy season looks like in Southeast Asia. It's not, it's like every drop is a bucket of water on you, and up to your knee, you're walking and at your own risk, places where it could be ditches and others.
So this little girl has a baby.
8,000 Thai baht in my bank account, which that time would be about $200. And I said, what are you doing? And she was like, in Thai language, I could speak to her. She wants to throw that kid, baby, in the water. And then I said, give it to me. Let's go to hospital. It doesn't matter. You can find the place. They can put it in a machine or something. So I bought a taxi. There are taxis roaming around at the very standing. We went to a hospital and I said to them, I have 8,000 baht, 5 baht. Take this and then I will sell my books or whatever, because my books were very expensive and I was very studious. I would buy every book, and I knew each of them cost about $100,
$200. Wow.
And I said, I will sell my books and I bring the rest you need, but put the kid of the baby.
Yes.
Her heart is beating. I could feel it. But anyways, today we are speaking. She is 18 or 19 years old. Her name is Sana. She was 7, 8 years old. I used to travel a lot. I used to give money to my mom, and she had everything for her school and everything. But by that time, I got in touch with her. My mom learned English, got a very good job, and everything went very well. And she's the one who said that we didn't tell you she has a plan name, but in her passport, her name is Sana. If we didn't ask you for permission, I should have to ask for permission. Sana is my nickname. I don't know. My mom called me that. It was me. And I think that's one of the biggest miracles I've seen in my life. I mean, that kid now is somebody and organization. I don't want to even get close to her because she has her own freedom. Mm-hmm. And that time I had to do what I have to do, but I don't have to continue. I'm trying to get disappear basically. And so much more.
Yeah.
I don't have fire. I hope I didn't give you a headache. Sometimes when I speak, I cannot spell.
Yes, thank you. Good stories. Thanks to God.
All right. Well, that was
wonderful. All right, James. We've been going at it an hour, so we could probably close it up now. Tell me about your puppy.
Sorry, go ahead.
Who's your dog?
Clement.
Oh, like a plush toy. He's so cute.
Anyhow, we've been talking about Energeia, and our guest has been Frederica Matthews Green. Find her on the web at frederica.com. Is it okay if I take the document that she sent to me and make it available for people to download?
Sure, go right ahead.
Wonderful. We'll have that at energeia.live/Frederica. Energeia.live/Frederica will have all of the resources that we talked about on this episode. And if the stars align, maybe we can have Frederica back on to talk about something else that has to do with the core theme of the show. But until then, it's been wonderful to.
Yes.
We got to know each other a little bit a few months ago, and now we're getting to know each other a little bit more here in this interview. Great. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, James. Thanks for having me on. And keep seeking that energeia. You'll receive it through prayer.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, James. I'm glad I get to meet your wife.
Yes.
Those are some wonderful stories. If you listen to Christians debating for an hour, you feel so crummy. But if you listen to Christians telling miracle stories for an hour, you walk out of the room like you're floating on air.
Yeah,
that should be a sign to us.
For me, while Sana was talking about, we don't want to win people to any particular way of thinking. We want to persuade people.
Yes. Yeah. And you persuade them by showing something that attracts them, something they love, not punching at them to show them how stupid they are.
People are
going to be interesting.
People are interested in the gospel. They're not interested in someone who's wording it, their superior knowledge of it. All right.
All right. Do this again some other time, James. Thanks for having me on.